As soon as they came through the cramped suit room, Aracilla pointed an accusing finger at Aaron. "That was you," she yelled in fury. "You're responsible. You told them to get clear. You knew who that was. You brought them here." "I didn't bring them here. Those people were going to catch up with us eventually. The location was unfortunate."
"Un-fucking-fortunate,"
Villitar spit. "There were nearly 200 people there. We don't know how many of them are still alive, but even if some of them survive the attack, they'll be dying from the radiation. My friends, slaughtered." "They'll be relifed," Aaron said impassively.
"You bastard,"
Cytus stepped forward, his fist raised. "Enough," Inigo said. "This won't help." Cytus paused for a moment, then turned away, his face contorted with disgust and anger.
"You knew, Earl?"
Nerina said. "You warned Anson as well. What the hell is going on? Do you know these people?" "I'm the one they're looking for. I didn't know about the attack." The rest of the team started at one another in mute bewilderment. "We're going to Kajani," Aracilla said. "We can help recover the bodies before the winds blow them too far." "How long before your organization sends another ship?" Aaron asked.
"Like you care."
"How long, please?" "Too long," Nerina said. "Hanko isn't part of the Unisphere. We can't just yell for help. Our only link to the Commonwealth was the hyperspace link in the starship, which was connected to our headquarters back on Anagaska. Without that, we're completely cut off. Anagaska will assume there was some kind of equipment failure. Then, after we haven't repaired it in a week, they'll probably investigate. If I remember right, we're due a scheduled flight in 2 weeks anyway. They'll probably wait until then. Budget considerations." She snapped it out with contempt. "By which time, radiation poisoning will have killed everyone exposed to the atmosphere," Villitar said. "We don't have enough medical facilities to help them all." "Congratulations." He stared challengingly at Aaron.
"We need to get moving," Aracilla said. "The medical systems on our ground crawlers can help a couple of them, maybe more."
She pushed her way past Aaron, not looking at him. Cytus managed to knock Aaron's elbow as he went into the suit room.
"You coming, Earl?"
Nerina asked.
"Yeah.
You've done enough already," Villitar said. "Whoever the fuck you really are, I thought..." He snarled incoherently and hurried into the suit room.
"We'll come with you,"
Coriolan said. "We can help." "The Asiatic Glacier is half a day from here," Nerina said. "The far end has mile-high cliffs. Why don't you help by driving off them?" She went into the suit room and closed the door. "Then there were three," Aaron said. "We'd better get going," Inigo said. He faced Aaron. "You know they'll probably close the restoration project down because of this."
"Do you think the next galaxy along will mount a restoration project for all the species which the void devourment phase exterminates?"
For a moment, Aaron thought Inigo might activate his bionics in an aggressor mode. "You know nothing," the Lost Messiah whispered.
"I hope something, though."
"What?"
"That you have a starship stashed away, preferably close by."
"I don't."
"Really? I find that mighty curious. You took all this trouble to stay lost, yet you have no escape route if someone came along to expose you."
"Obviously not. Otherwise I wouldn't have been here waiting for you."
"You wouldn't have been waiting around here if it had just been me," Aaron said. He gestured at Coriolan.
"But her? That's different. 70 years is a long time to be alone. She stayed in love for that long."
"Did you?"
Coriolan moved close to Winnego.
"Did you?"
she asked in a quiet voice. A mournful smile flickered over his lips. "I'm glad it was you. Is that enough?"
"Yeah."
She rested her head on his shoulder. "No ship," Inigo told Aaron, "and the only way I go anywhere with you is in a bag of small lumps of charcoal. That's a shame, because I know what weapon they used to take out my starship and the base." "Is that supposed to impress me? I expect you know a great deal about weapons and violence. Men like you always do."
"It was a Hawking M-Sync," Aaron said. "Do you know what that is?"
"No."
"They're new and highly dangerous. Even ANA gets nervous around them. Basically, it's a very small black hole, but cranked up with an outsize event horizon to help absorption. It starts off as a little core of neutronium, about the size of an atomic nucleus."
Coriolan caught the emphasis.
"Starts off?"
"Yes.
Its gravity field is strong enough to pull in any atoms it comes into contact with. They're then also compressed into neutronium and merge with its core. With each atom it gets a little bit bigger. Not by much, admittedly, not to begin with. But the larger the surface area, the more matter it can absorb. And after it tore through the Artful Dodger, it hit the planet. Right now it is sinking through the mantle, eating every atom it encounters. It'll stop at the center of the planet. Then it just sits there and grows.
How big will it get? She asked anxiously.
Aaron shot Inigo a look. Black holes have no theoretical size limit. We used to think that was what the void was.
But, Hanko...
It'll take about 2 weeks to devour the entire mass of an 8 congruous world. Except we'll be dead long before that. Hanko will start to disintegrate as it's consumed from within. The continents will collapse in 3 or 4 days. So, once more, with an awful lot of feeling, do you have a starship hidden nearby? Araminta kissed 3 of hims as they sat at a table under a gazebo of flowering Ysanthal in his garden. I missed that, she told the rugged Oriental one. Mr. Bovey smiled in unison. He's raised his glasses. Cheers.
Cheers.
She sipped her white wine. So? Asked the one she had had their first dinner with. Araminta steeled herself.
If your offer is still open, I'd like to accept.
She even heard cheering coming from the big house, as well as the racket that the 3 under the gazebo made. You've made some old men very happy.
Us young ones, too.
Araminta laughed, and I have absolutely no idea how to go about this. The first 3 apartments will be ready in another week. I've accepted a deposit on the 4th. Congratulations. But until I've completed it and the tenants are in, I won't see a profit. I need money to buy bodies. Not as expensive as you might think. A friend, one of us, runs a clinic expressly for that purpose. She always gives a discount to a first expander.
Okay.
She took another drink to calm her shudders. It was momentous, sort of like accepting 2 proposals at once. The young Celtic one squeezed her arm.
You all right? He asked, all full of sympathy.
I guess so.
She knew she was smiling like an idiot, but this does feel right. 2 of hims came hurrying out of the house. One of them, who seemed about 17, went down on his knee beside her. A slim, athletic build, she saw, with a wild shock of blonde hair. He proffered a small box, which opened to show her an antique diamond engagement ring.
I bought it just in case, he told her.
Araminta slipped it onto her finger, then dashed away the tears.
Oh, come here,
the youngster exclaimed. His arms went around her, hugging her tight, and she was laughing through the tears.
I haven't seen you before.
I'm a slave driver to me.
She put her palms on his cheeks and kissed him thoroughly.
I would like you to be one of tonight's.
My considerable pleasure.
I believe you said I still have several of yous to get to know.
Oh, trust me, you'll know all of me's before our wedding day.
And I don't mind and won't complain about other women until I have enough bodies to cope. Just, I don't want to meet them.
I'll try to keep it to a minimum, I promise.
Thanks,
she whispered gratefully.
Now, what sort of bodies are you going to go for?
Gosh, I hadn't thought about that, she admitted.
What do you like?
Got to be a tall blonde Amazon type. Always popular. Oh, and very black as well. Let's cover all the old ethnicities.
I have, almost.
And one of you has to have huge breasts.
More than one?
She slapped at him, feigning shocked dismay.
You're appalling. I'm not doing anything like that.
That's not what you usually say in bed.
Araminta laughed. She really had missed this. I made the right decision. Araminta lay on the big bed, listening to 3 of hims sleeping, 2 on the bed with her and 1 on the couch, curled up in a quilt, all breathing softly, not quite in sync. This time she had refused any aerosols, wanting to try out Lycan's program to make sure it worked with other people, that he hadn't loaded in a hidden expiry key. It worked. And how? Mr. Bovey had been surprised, and then very appreciative, at how much more responsive her body had become. As she had suspected, A night in bed with hymns had been a lot better than it had been with Lycan and the harem. Always nice to have confirmation. Now she could not sleep. Not that she wasn't tired, she grinned to herself, but she couldn't stop thinking about the engagement and embracing a multiple lifestyle. It was such an upheaval. Everything was going to change for her, so much so that she was more than a little apprehensive. Her mind was churning over the same questions again and again, unable to find answers because she didn't actually know about being multiple. The only way to find out was to become one. She turned her head to look at the young red-haired him who was nestled cosily beside her. He'd help her through the transition, she knew. Mr. Bovey loved her. That was enough to take her through the next few months. They hadn't set a date. He had said he would like at least 2 hers to register the marriage with him, which was fair enough. She really needed to finish the apartments. This day's events had made that even more urgent. Araminta settled back onto the soft mattress and closed her eyes. She used the program to still her whirling thoughts, emptying her mind. Her body started to calm as she found and slowed its natural rhythms, cycling down. Instead of sleep, the emptiness opening within made her aware of the images that lurked just below conscious thought. There was not just one, but a whole range, all tasting and feeling very different. They twisted out of the infinite distance, a connection she now finally understood belonged to her. Instinctively, she knew how to focus on whichever images she wanted. Some were Mr. Bovey's dreams. She was familiar enough with him to recognize his mental scent. She sighed fondly as she experienced his presence. Part of his mind was so wound up, the poor man. She also felt his happiness. Her own face slithered in and out of his thoughts. One of the connections was completely alien, yet comfortably warm in the way a parent was with a child. Her lips lifted in a serene smile. The Sylphan mother home. So Cressida had been telling the truth, in which case that oh-so-busy chorus of multicolored shadows must be the Gaia field. Araminta embraced the quiet one, the most tenuous connection of all, and found herself gliding through space, far from any star. The void's nebulae glimmered lush and glorious behind her as she rose to the darkness of the outer regions. "Hello," she said, and the Sky Lord answered. Justine had expected to feel a lot of excitement as her starship, the Silverbird, descended towards Centurion Station. 500 hours alone in a small cabin with no Unisphere connection had left her unexpectedly strung out. Intellectually, she knew it was nonsense, a quirk of her primitive body's biochemistry and neurological weakness, but it was still real. Now here she was, at her destination, and all she could think about was the identical boring trip back. I must have been crazy to do this. The Silverbird touched down on the lava field that acted as a spacecraft for the human section of Centurion Station. 5 other starships were sitting there, all of them bigger than hers. The Smart Corps reported several discrete sensor scans probing at the ship. The tall Ethox tower was the worst offender, using quite aggressive quantum signature detectors. More subtle scans came from the dour domes of the Forlene. There was even a quick burst of investigative activity from the observatory facilities in the human section. She smiled at that as her thin spacesuit squeezed up against her body, expelling all the air pockets to form an outer protective skin. She locked the helmet on. It was a short walk over the sandy lava to the main airlock. Justine needed it for the sense of space and normality it gave her. She could not believe how much she felt reassured by the sight of a planetary horizon, even one as drab as this. When she stopped to look up, angry ion storms fluoresced the sky for light years in every direction, pale mockeries of the nebulae inside the void. Director Leia Trachtenberg was waiting for her in the reception hall beyond the airlock, a formidably sized man who reminded her of Ramon, one of her old husbands. Standing in front of him, shaking his hand in greeting and tipping her head back to see his face, was another reminder of how negligible her physical body was. Of course, that Ramon connection did shunt her mind back to the possibility of sex. "This is a considerable honor," Leia Trachtenberg was saying. ANA has never sent a representative here before. Given the political circumstances back in the Commonwealth, it was deemed appropriate to examine the data from the void firsthand. The director licked his lips slowly.
Distance makes no difference to data, Justine. We do send the entire range of our findings directly back to the Navy's Exploration Division and the Rael.
Nonetheless, I'd like the opportunity to review your operation.
I wasn't about to refuse you anything, especially after the trip you've just made. To my knowledge, no one has ever traveled so far by themselves. How did you stand the isolation?
She suspected that he suspected the Silverbird had an ultra drive, but chose to gloss over the actual journey time. With difficulty and a lot of sensory dramas.
I can imagine. He gestured at the 5-seater cab that was waiting at the end of the reception hall. I've assigned you a suite in the Mexico accommodation block.
Thank you.
I'm also throwing a welcome party for you in 3 hours. Everyone is very keen to meet you.
I suppose they are, she said. Fine, I'll be there. I could do with some company after that trip.
They climbed into the little cab, which immediately shot into the transport tunnel. I should warn you that nearly a third of our observation staff are living dream followers, the director said.
I reviewed personnel files before I came.
As long as you know.
Is it a problem?
Hopefully not. But as you implied, it's a volatile situation right now.
Don't worry. I can do diplomatic when I have to.
Her suite was equal to any luxury hotel she had stayed in. The only thing missing was human staff, but the number of modern bots more than made up for it. The Navy clearly had spared no effort in making the station as cozy as possible for the scientists. The main room even had a long window looking out over the alien sections of the station. Justine stared at them for a while, then opaqued the glass. Her U-shadow established itself in the room's net. No visitors or calls, she told it. Justine settled back onto the bed and opened her mind to the local Gaia field. The darkened room filled with phantoms, with their colors glinting amid the deeper shadows. Voices whispered. There was laughter. She felt drawn to various emotional states that promised to immerse her in their enticing, soulful sensations. Resisting temptation, she focused her attention on the source of the whimsy, the confluence nest itself, a quasi-biological neural module that simultaneously stored and emitted every thought released into its field. It had memories like a human brain, only with a much, much larger capacity. Justine formed her own images, offering them up to the nest. It responded with association. Naturally, it contained every one of Inigo's dreams. Living Dream had made sure of that. She ignored the vivid spectacle of the Water Walker's life, brushing those memories aside as she refined her own fancy for a different recollection of life inside the void. The nest was full of enigmas, the mental poetry left behind by observers, baffled by the terrible dark heart of the galaxy. There were compositions of how a life might be lived for anyone fortunate to pass inside, wish fulfillment, easy to differentiate from the real thing. They were the promise prayers that Living Dream's followers made every night to their mystic goal. All were imprinted on the nest, but nothing else. No other glimpse into another life lived on Querencia. No grand mellow thoughts originating from a sky lord. The garden dome at the middle of the human section boasted trees over 250 years old. Oaks with thick trunks sent out thick crinkled boughs, acting as lush canopies above the tables where the station staff was gathering. Up on a rustic treehouse platform, an enthusiastic amateur band was playing songs from different eras, stretching back across several centuries, and was keen for requests. It was dusk inside, allowing the sharp violet light of the wall stars to dominate the sky overhead. Justine admired the broad patch of ice-searing scintillations, with the kind of wariness she reserved for dangerous animals. Her arrival in the garden dome had created quite a ripple of interest. She liked to think that was due at least partly to the little black cocktail dress she had chosen. It certainly seemed to have the required effect on Director Trachtenberg, who was becoming quite flirtatious as he fussed around, offering her various drinks and selections of the finger food. Everyone she was introduced to was keen to know exactly what ANA's interest was in them at this time. She repeated the official line a dozen times. She was visiting just to ascertain the current status of the observation. "Unchanged," complained Grafal Ehaz,
the observation department chief. We don't learn anything these days apart from ion storm patterns in the gulf on the other side of the wall stars. That tells us nothing about the nature of the beast. We should be trying to send probes inside.
I thought nothing could get through the barrier, she said.
Which is why we need a much more detailed study. You can't do that with remote probes, 50 light-years away.
The Rael don't like us getting closer,
Trachtenberg said. When you get home, you might ask ANA why we still need their permission just to fart around here, Ehas said. It's fucking insulting.
I'll remember, Justine said.
The party was only 20 minutes old. She wondered how many aerosols Ehas had inhaled. The director took her by the arm and politely guided her away.
Sorry about that, he said.
There's not a lot of opportunity to blow off steam around here. I run a pretty tight schedule. This is an expensive installation and phenomenally important. We need to extract the best information we can with what we've got.
I understand.
It's Ehas's third stint out here. He tends to get frustrated by the lack of progress. I've seen it before. First time you're all swept along by the wonder of it all. Then, when that fades away, you begin to realize how passive the observation actually is.
How many times have you been here?
He grinned. This is my 7th. But then I'm a lot older and wiser than Ehas.
So would you like to join the pilgrimage?
Not really. As far as 300 years of direct observation has shown us, you touch the barrier, you die. Actually, you die a long time before you reach the barrier. I just don't see how they hope to get through.
Somebody did, once.
Yeah, that's the really annoying part.
So what do... Justine stopped as the ground heaved, almost knocking her feet out from under her. She tensed, dropping to a crouch, like just about everyone else. Her integral force field came on. The local net was shrieking out all sorts of alarms. The huge oak boughs creaked dangerously, their leaves rustling as if tickled by a gust of wind.
Oh, shit! Trachtenberg yelped.
Justine's U-shadow established a link to the Silverbird smart core. Stand by, she told it. Keep a fix on my position. When she scanned the dome, it was still intact. Then she looked at the horizon, which appeared to be perfectly level. She had been expecting big cracks to be splitting the lava plain open at the very least. The ground tilted again. Nothing moved.
What is happening?
She demanded aloud. Some kind of quake? But this planet was a dead husk, completely inactive in any respect.
I'm not sure.
The director waved an annoyed hand to shush her. The members of the band were clambering down out of the treehouse as fast as they could go, jumping the last meter off the wooden steps. They had abandoned their instruments. Justine stared at the drink in her hand as the ground shifted again. The wine sloshed from one side of the glass to the other, yet she was holding it perfectly still.
Holy Aussie,
Trachtenberg exclaimed. It's gravity.
What?
Gravity waves.
Fucking colossal ones.
Ehas hurried over to them, swaying badly as the ground seemed to tilt again.
Are you accessing the long-range sensors? He yelled at Trachtenberg. What have they got?
The boundary. There are distortion ripples, light-years long, moving across it, and the damn thing is growing.
The sensors in the gulf can actually see it move.
Do you realize what that means?
The expansion is superluminal. This is an Aussie fucking devourment phase.
The ground quivered badly. Water running along the little streams sloshed about, shooting up small jets of spray. For a moment, Justine actually felt her weight reduce. Then it came back, and the neat stacks of crockery and glasses on the tables crashed onto the grass. She stumbled away from the oak tree as it emitted a nasty splintering sound. Emergency force fields were coming on, reinforcing the dome. Around the rim, the doors to safety bunkers rippled open.
I want everyone to move to evacuation stage 1, Trachtenberg announced. Navy personnel, report direct to your ships. Observation team, I need a precise picture of what is happening out there. We probably don't have much time, so we must do as much as we can before we're forced off.
He flinched as another gravity wave crossed the station. This time the upward force was so strong that Justine felt like she was going to lift off.
Is that gravity coming from the void? She asked.
The prospect was terrifying, as they were hundreds of light-years away.
No, Ehas cried. This is something local.
He looked up, studying the intricate luminescent sky above the dome.
There.
Justine watched two azure moons traverse the sparkling smear of wall stars. They were in very strange orbits and moving impossibly fast, actually accelerating. "Oh, my God," she gasped. The Rael's planet-sized DF machines were flying into new positions. "The Rael are getting ready for the last fight," Ehas said numbly. "If they lose, that monster will consume the whole galaxy." "This can't be happening," Justine thought. "Living Dream hasn't even begun the pilgrimage yet." "You can't!" she shouted up at the ancient, invisible enemy, as human hormones and feelings took complete control of her body and mind. "This isn't fair! It's not fair!" A mere 5 hours after the new Dream had flooded into the Gaia field, over 50,000 of the devout had gathered in Golden Park, seeking guidance from the cleric conservator. They exerted their wish through their Gaiamotes. The unanimous desire of 50,000 people was an astonishing force. Ethan was only too aware of it as Councillor Phelim supported him on the long, painful walk out of the mayor's offices, where the doctors had set up an intensive care bay. He limped across the floor of Lailala Hall, while the ceiling displayed surges of thick cumulus clouds arrayed in mare's tails and clad in shimmering strands of lightning. Even though he had closed himself to the Gaia field, the power of the crowd's craving was leaking into his bruised brain. Phelim continued to support him as they crossed the smaller Toral Hall. Its midnight ceiling showed the Ku Nebula with its twinkling gold sparks swimming within fat, undulating jade and sapphire nimbi. "You should have called them to your bed," Phelim said. "No," Ethan grunted. For this occasion he would not, could not, show weakness. They went through the carved doors to the Orchard Palace's upper council chamber. Its cross-vault ceiling was supported by broad fan pillars. Dominating the apex of the central segment, a fuzzy copper star shone brightly, its light shimmering off a slowly rotating accretion disk. Moon-sized fireball comets circled the outer band in high-inclination orbits. None of Macathran's enthusiastic astronomers had ever spied its location in the void. The cleric council waited for him in their scarlet and black robes, standing silently at the long table that ran across the middle of the chamber. Phelim stayed by Ethan's side until they reached the dais, and then Ethan insisted on walking to his gold-embossed throne by himself. He eased himself onto the thin cushions with a grimace. The pain in his head nearly made him cry out as he sank down. He took a moment to recover as his body shuddered. Ever since he had regained consciousness, any sudden movement was agony. The councillors sat, trying to avert their eyes from the liver-like semi-organic nodules affixed to his skull, which were only half hidden by his white robe's voluminous hood. "Thank you for attending," Ethan said to them. "We are relieved to see you recovered, Cleric Conservator," Rincenzo said formally. Ethan knew the contempt of the other councillors toward his supporter without needing the Gaia field. He felt it himself. "Not quite recovered yet," he said, and tapped one of the glistening nodules, "but my neural structure should be fully re-established in another week. Until then, the auxiliaries will suffice." "How could such a thing happen?" Councillor DeLuy asked. "Gaiamotes have been perfectly safe for centuries." "It wasn't the Gaiamotes," Phelim said. "The Dream Masters, who set up the interception, believe the second Dreamer's panic triggered a neural spasm within the Cleric Conservator's brain. They were attuned to a degree rarely achieved outside a couple's most intimate dream-sharing. The circumstances will not arise again. The Gaia field and the Unisphere are rife with rumors that the second Dreamer is a genuine telepath, that he can kill with a single thought." "Rubbish," Phelim said. His skeletal face turned to DeLuy. For an instant, a dangerous anger could be glimpsed in his mind. DeLuy could not meet his stare. "In any case, it is irrelevant," Ethan said. "The Dream Masters assure me that such a backlash can be nullified, now that they understand its nature. Any future contact with the second Dreamer will be conducted with," he smiled grimly, "a safety cutout, as they call it." "You're going to talk to him again?" Councillor Falvin asked. "I believe the situation requires it," Ethan said. "Don't you?"
"Well, yes, but I received his latest dream along with the rest of you. It was strong, at least as clear as those of the Dreamer Inigo himself. However,
The crucial change within this dream was the conversation the second dreamer had with the Sky Lord. The communication had shocked Ethan more than the pristine clarity of the new dream had. "I came to find you," the Sky Lord had replied to the second dreamer's greetings. "We are far beyond the edge of your universe, yet I felt your longing. You wish to join with us?"
"Not I, but others do, yes."
"All are welcome."
"We can't get in. It's very dangerous."
"I can greet you. I can guide you. It's my purpose."
"No."
And with that finality, the dream had ended. Before it had faded completely, there was a hint of agitation from the Sky Lord's mind. It clearly had not expected rejection. And it's hardly alone in that.
"The Sky Lord believes it can bring us to Querencia," Ethan said.
"That is the final testimony we have been waiting and praying for. Our pilgrimage will be blessed with success."
"Not without the second dreamer," Councillor Tosine said. "Your pardon, Conservator, but he is not willing to lead us into the void. Without him there can be no pilgrimage."
"He is distressed," Ethan replied. "Until now he didn't even know he was the second dreamer.
To discover you are the hope of billions is not an easy thing. Ultimately, Inigo himself found it too great to bear. So we can forgive the second dreamer his frailty and offer support and guidance."
"He might realize who and what he is now," Councillor Tosine said. "But we don't even know where he is."
"Actually, we do," Phelim announced. "Colwyn City on Vyosha."
"Excellent news,"
Ethan said in a predatory fashion. He watched in amusement as the protests in Tosine's mind withered away. "We should welcome him and thank Vyosha for the gift it has brought us." His gaze turned expectantly on Rincenzo.
"I would like to propose bringing Vyosha fully into the Free Trade Zone," Rincenzo said, "and promote it to core planet status."
"Seconded," Falvin said.
The rest of the cleric council responded with bemusement.
"You can't do that," Tosine said. "They'll resist. The Commonwealth Senate will move to censure us. We'll lose every diplomatic advantage we have."
He glanced around the table, seeking support.
"It's not just our ambition," Phelim said. He gestured at the empty end of the table opposite Ethan's dais. His U-shadow established the ultra-secure link, and a portal projected an image of Lycan standing just beyond the table. Lycan bowed politely.
"Conservator, I am honored."
"Thank you," Ethan said. "I believe you are acting as an unofficial emissary for your government."
"Yes, sir. I have just finished talking with our Prime Minister. It is her wish to accept Elezalin's generous offer to elevate us to core world status within the Free Trade Zone."
"That's wonderful news. I will inform Elezalin's cabinet of your decision."
"The acceptance comes with the understanding that a zero-tariff regime will be part of the accord," Lycan said.
"Of course.
Full trade will commence as soon as the second dreamer joins us here in Makathran II."
"Understood. The Prime Minister will award the treaty her certificate of office as soon as it is sent."
Lycan's image vanished.
"I believe,"
Ethan said into the startled silence, "that we were about to take a vote."
"Those in favour?"
He watched the hands being raised. It was unanimous. In moments such as this, he almost missed Corilin's presence on the council. She never would have let such a Soviet-style outcome go unchallenged.
"Thank you. I find your support of my policies to be humbling. There is no further business."
Phelim remained seated as the others filed out. Flecks of light slid across his expressionless face as the comets orbited ceaselessly overhead.
"That was easy,"
Ethan remarked.
"They don't know what to do," Phelim said. "They're just the same as the devout gathering outside, bewildered and hurt that the second dreamer would reject the Sky Lord. They're in need of strong, positive leadership. You provide that. You have the solution. Naturally, they turn to you."
"When can we open the wormhole?"
"I'll have your government office send the treaty to Vyosha's Prime Minister immediately. If Lycan doesn't let us down, it'll come straight back. The wormhole can be opened within 2 hours. We've prepared a number of sites for it to emerge."
"I hope Colwyn City was one of them."
"Yes, it has a dock complex that will serve us very nicely."
"And our police forces?"
40,000 ready for immediate dispatch, along with transport and riot suppression equipment. We can push them through within 6 hours of opening the wormhole. Another 250,000 will follow over the next 4 days.
Excellent.
I hoped you'd approve. Phelim hesitated. We never planned on the second dreamer becoming aware of his ability in quite this fashion. It'll take us a day to get our dream masters into position across Colwyn.
But you can shut down all capsule and starship traffic before then.
Yes, that's our highest priority. We want to confine him within the city boundary. Again, the uncharacteristic hesitation. But in order to locate him, he has to dream again. After tonight, he might not.
Ethan closed his eyes and sank down onto the throne, enervated by his exertion. He will. He doesn't know what he's done yet.
What do you mean?
An hour ago, I received a call from Director Trachtenberg at the Centurion Station. He considered it important enough to reveal his affiliation to us and use the Navy's relay posts. Just after the second dreamer ended his contact with the Sky Lord, the Void began a devourment phase. That is not coincidence. It would seem the Sky Lord doesn't take rejection lightly. Our reclusive friend will have to placate it, or we'll all wind up being consumed by the boundary. Quite an incentive, really. Inigo's seventh dream. Ediard woke with a mild hangover. Again. Last night was the third in a row he had been out with Maxon and Boyd. He sat up in bed and ordered the light on. The high-curving ceiling started to shine with a low cream radiance. One of his three G-chimps hurried over with a glass of water and a small compaction of powder he'd gotten from Dr. Marusa's apprentice. Ediard popped the little pellet onto his tongue and took a drink to swallow it. His mind drifted back to that morning, years before in Witham, when Fahin had mixed his awful concoction of a hangover cure. It was still the most effective he'd ever had. Ediard was sure the pellets were little more than placebos, providing the apprentice with a small regular source of income. He finished the water quickly. Fahin had always said water helped flush away the toxins. The circular bath pool in the maisonette's bathroom now had a series of small steps at one end, so Ediard could walk down into it. He immersed himself up to his neck, settling into the seat shelf, and sighed in gratification. A G-chimp poured in a liquid soap that produced a lot of bubbles. He closed his eyes again, waiting for the hangover to ebb. The water temperature was perfect, exactly body warmth. It had taken him a couple of weeks of experimenting to get that right. The bathing water in Macathran was normally quite chilly for humans. He also had remodeled the hole in the floor that served as a toilet. Now the ubiquitous wooden box employed by every Macathran household had gone, replaced by a simple hollow pedestal that the room had grown for him. It was so much easier to sit on. Various other little modifications had turned the maisonette into quite a cozy home. The standard two-high, cube-shaped bed was now a lot lower, its spongy upper surface softer and more accommodating. Alcoves had shelves in them. One deep nook in the kitchen area was permanently chilly, allowing him to keep food fresh for days, just like the larger city palaces did. That was the greatest blessing of being in the constable's tenement rather than the station dormitory. Ediard finally could choose what he ate again. Half of his first month's pay had gone on a new iron stove. He had installed it himself, adapting the hole the previous tenant had hacked into the wall for the flue. It had pride of place in the kitchen, along with a growing collection of pans. There was even a small basin that could be used for washing up, rather than dumping everything into the bath pool, as most people did. He liked that innovation enough to consider sculpting another one in the bathroom, just for his hands and face, although that really would let everyone know he had the ability to rearrange the city's fabric, sculpting it as easily as he once had made Genistar eggs. Everyone who visited the maisonette. So, no one, then. Maxin had brought a girl back from the theatre the previous night, one of the dancers. She was as pretty as any of the grand family girls, but with an incredibly strong, supple body. He knew that because of the revealing clothes she wore when she danced on stage. Ediard gritted his teeth and tried not to be jealous. He and Boyd had struck out again, though overall it had been a pleasant evening. Ediard enjoyed going to the theatre a lot more than sitting in taverns getting drunk. There were often several musicians up on the stage, always guild apprentices, young and with passion. Just listening to some of their songs, so full of contempt for the city authorities, made him feel wickedly disloyal to the Grand Council. But he knew the words to many of the popular ones, of which several were Diebold's compositions. It was loud in the theatres, some of which were no more than underground storerooms. He had been startled the first time he heard drums being played. It was as if the musicians somehow had tamed thunder. One day they would go and see Diebold playing, so Maxen promised. Ediard hoped it would be soon. The bubble started to disappear from the pool as the water cycled through the narrow slits around the bottom. Ediard groaned and climbed out. A G-chimp had a robe waiting for him. He pulled it on as he walked through into the kitchen area, and then sat at the small table. It was right next to a cinquefoil window, giving him a view over the rooftops toward the center of the city. A G-chimp placed a glass of apple and mango juice on the table, along with a bowl of mixed oats, nuts, and dried fruit. The juice was nicely chilled. The G-chimps knew to leave it in the cold nook for an hour before serving it. He poured cold milk into the bowl and started to eat, looking out across the city as it came to life under the rising sun. It would have been a fine life indeed if he could just stop brooding about all the lawlessness haunting the streets and canals he could see. The squad had finally managed to get some convictions in the courts over the last few weeks, but nothing important. Some shop thieves in their early teens, a mugger who was drunk most of the time. One time the Guild of Clerks sent them out to arrest a landlord for defaulting on taxes. They had no impact whatsoever on the gangs that were at the heart of Macathran's problems. "You ready?" Cansine long talked as Ediard buttoned up his tunic. He pulled his boots on. They were new, costing over 3 days' pay, but well worth it. "Coming." She was waiting on the walkway outside, an oilskin cloak slung over her arm. "Going to rain today," she announced. He eyed the wide, clear sky. "If you say so." She grinned as they started down the awkward stairs. Every morning he was so tempted to sculpt them into something less dangerous, writing the miracle off to the lady. "This'll be your first winter in the city, won't it?" she asked. "Yes." Ediard couldn't quite imagine Macathran being cold and icebound. The long summer had been gloriously hot. He had become what he considered to be a good football player, with his team finishing third in Jeevans's little park league. Most taverns had seats and tables outside, where many pleasant evenings had been spent. There had even been a few days when he had started sketching again, not that he showed anyone the results. After saving up some coinage, he and Salrana finally had taken a gondola ride around the city. "It'll be fun," Cansine said. "There's loads of parties leading up to the new year. Then the mayor throws a huge free ox roast in Golden Park for lunch on the New Year's Day, except everyone is normally so hungover that they're late, and the parks and plazas all look so clean and fresh when they're covered in snow." "Sounds good. You'll need a thick coat and a hat. On our pay. I know some shops that sell quality clothes for reasonable prices. Thanks. And don't forget to get in an early supply of coal for your stove. The buildings are never quite warm enough in midwinter, and the price always goes through the roof after the first snowfall. The lady will damn those merchants. It's criminal what they get away with charging." "You're happy this morning?" "My sister's having her boy's naming ceremony this Saturday. She's asked me to be a nominee for the lady." "Nice. What's she going to call him?" "Dayum, after the third mayor." "Ah, right. And you haven't got a clue who that is, do you?" He grinned broadly. "Nope." She laughed. That was the way it was between them these days. Best friends. Any discomfiture left over from that night after graduation had long faded, which he was sort of pleased about. He did not want them to be awkward around each other, but still he couldn't quite forget that kiss, or the way both of them had felt. He'd never had the courage to bring up what they'd said. Neither had she. That had left him wrestling with his thoughts about Salrana, who was always so sunny and generally lovely. It was now incredibly hard to ignore how feminine she had become, and he suspected that she knew that. Of late, her teasing had taken on quite an edge. The rest of the squad was waiting in the main hall at the Jeevans Constable Station, sitting around a table and finishing breakfast. Unlike Ediard, few of them cooked for themselves. Maxon had on a pair of glasses with very dark lenses, not too dissimilar to those Diebold wore. Cansine took one look at him and burst out laughing.
Were you boys out in the theatres again last night?
Maxon grunted and scowled at her over his cup of strong black coffee. Ediard desperately wanted to ask him what Nanit, the dancer, was like. It must have been a fantastic night to leave him so wrecked. But friends though they were, Cancine did not have much tolerance for that kind of all-boys-together talk.
Some news for you,
Boyd hissed, checking the rest of the hall's bench tables to make sure no one was paying attention.
Go on,
Ediard said as he drew up a chair. There was something almost comical about Boyd's behaviour.
My brother Isowix is being leaned on again. They came to the shop yesterday evening as he was shutting up and said that they wanted £20 to put out the fire. They're coming back this morning to collect.
Ediard did not like it. 3 times in the last few months, Boyd had told them about gang members harassing his brother at the family bakery. There never had been a specific threat, just warnings about falling into line, softening him up. Well, now the demand had been made.
That's very stupid of them, he said slowly.
What do you mean?
Dinlay asked. They must know Isowix's brother is a constable. Why would they risk it? There are hundreds of shops in Jeevans without that kind of connection.
They're gang members,
Dinlay said,
greedy and stupid. This time too greedy and too stupid.
The ones that turn up won't be important,
Cancine said. Thugs who are affiliated, that's all.
Are you saying we shouldn't help him?
Boyd asked hotly.
No,
Ediard said. Of course not. We'll be there to make the arrest. You know that. What Cancine is saying is that this arrest alone won't stop the problem. Maxon hooked a finger over his glasses and pulled them down to look over the tops of the rims.
We've got to start somewhere, he croaked.
You make it sound like we're the ones who are going to break the gangs, Cancine said.
Somebody has to. I don't see the mayor or the chief constable doing it.
Oh, come on.
He shrugged and pushed his glasses back up. They all looked at Ediard. Let's go, he said, and make sure you're all wearing your dross silk waistcoats. I don't want to have to explain casualties to Captain Ronark.
Boyd's family bakery was at the northern end of Macoun Street, not far from the Outer Circle Canal. The street was narrow and twisty, with Baroque buildings lined up on either side, making direct observation difficult. At ground level, the sharp turns limited the squad's farsight. The 3-story bakery had a central square tower with a soft-ridged mansard-style roof. Tall crescent dormer windows protruded above a mid-story balcony. Beneath that, the lower floor was reached by several flowing steps from the street that led to a wide entrance arch between 2 curving bay windows. Each one was filled with racks of loaves and cakes. 3 ugly metal chimney stacks from the coal-fired ovens rose out of holes hacked into the tower eaves, blowing thin smoke into the dampening air. Ediard positioned his squad carefully. The gang would want a fast exit route, so Maxon and Dinlay were in a shop between the bakery and the canal. Cancine was covering the other end of Macoun Street, wandering around the stalls of a small arcade, her cloak covering her uniform. Ediard had settled down in the first-floor living room opposite. It belonged to a family who ran a clothing shop on the ground floor and was close friends with Isowix. Boyd had returned home for the day and was helping out in the bakery, dressing for the part in a white apron and a green cap. Ediard was uncertain if he should use the G-Eagle. In the end, he settled for having it perch in a deep, guttering furrow on the bakery's tower, almost invisible from ground level. It scared the Rugals away, but no one else noticed it. At least we won't have to escort them far to the courts of injustice, Maxon pointed out as they started their vigil. Ediard actually could see one of the conical towers of Parliament House through the living room's balcony window. They waited for 2 hours. Among them they raised the alarm 5 times, only to be proved wrong on each occasion.
So many citizens look so disreputable, Cancine declared, after a couple of adolescents ran down the street after their third hands had snatched oranges from a grocery shop display, and acted.
We're all paranoid today, that's all, Maxon long talked back. We see the bad in everyone.
Is that a song title?
Dinlay asked. Ediard smiled at the banter. There was a lot to be said for being squad leader. He was sitting in a comfortable armchair, drinking tea that the wife of the shop owner kept bringing up for him.
She brought a nice plate of biscuits each time, too. His good humor faded as the young hooligans turned a corner out of sight. Foreboding rose into his mind, strong enough to make his skin tingle. He knew that awful sensation from before. "Oh, shit," he whimpered. "Edyard?" Kansine queried. "It's happening." "What is?" Maxon said. "They're here. It's about to start."
"Where are they?" Boyd asked. "Which ones?"
"I don't know," Edyard said. "Look, just trust me. Please be careful. I know we have to be." He could sense the uncertainty in their minds. They were not used to hearing him say such things. It was difficult to get to his feet. His body was reacting so badly. When he did press up against the balcony window, he found it hard to concentrate on the street below.
"I think I see them," Boyd said.
Two youngish men were walking up the steps into the shop, while a third stood outside. Through Boyd's eyes, Edyard and the rest of the squad watched them swagger into the shop. Isowix straightened up behind the counter. "I told you before," he said, "I don't have that kind of money."
"Yes, you do,"
the first man said. His gaze kept darting nervously to Boyd, who was standing at the other end of the counter from Isowix. Wrong, Edyard knew. Why would a gang member be worried about a shop assistant? "Boyd, he knows what you are," Edyard sent in the most direct long talk he could manage, praying the gang members would not pick it out of the general background of Macathran's telepathic babble.
"Huh?"
Boyd grunted. The gang member glanced at him again, then turned back to Isowix. "Give me £20 or we'll torch this place," he said loudly. "No," Edyard said. The hairs on his neck were standing proud. "No, no, no. Wrong." "You," Boyd said. He pulled his apron aside to reveal a constable's badge pinned on his waistcoat. The two gang members turned to face him. "I am a city constable, and I am placing you under arrest for threatening behavior with intent to extort."
"How do you like that, you bastards?"
a gloating Isowix shouted. "Everyone close in," Edyard ordered. He pushed through the narrow door onto the balcony. The gang members left on the street glanced up and smiled.
"Oh, shit," Edyard growled. "It's him," the gang member declared in powerful long talk.
Then he started running. Inside the bakery, the first gang member pulled out a small knife. He flung it at Boyd, who swayed backward. His third hand just managed to push the blade aside. Isowix snatched a much larger knife and threw it at the gang members as they fled through the doorway. It whirled into the street, narrowly missing a woman who was walking by. She screamed. Edyard vaulted over the balcony rail and dropped to the street below. He landed badly, rolling as his ankle gave way. His shoulder smacked into one of the steps leading up to the clothing shop's door. He yelled at the bright pulse of pain, tears squeezing out of his eyes. His farsight caught Boyd, leaping over the bakery counter. Kansine was sprinting up Macoon Street, her cloak abandoned on the ground by the stalls. Maxon and Dinlay were moving out of their shop, confident and eager. Their shields combined as they stood in the middle of the street, blocking the way. All three gang members were racing toward them.
"Let them go," Edyard ordered.
Maxon's face registered bewilderment that came close to anger.
"What?"
Edyard had regained his feet and started to totter down the street.
"Leave them." "You can't be serious."
The three gang members were barely 20 yards from Maxon and Dinlay. "It's a setup. They knew we were here."
"Crap,"
Dinlay sent.
"I can scan them completely. They've got a couple of small blades between them. That's all."
"There'll be more, somewhere, waiting for us. Please, just let them go. I'll track them with the G-Eagle." Maxon hesitated. He took a step toward the side of the street.
"No!"
Dinlay hissed fiercely. He opened his arms wide as the three gang members charged toward them.
"Dinlay, stop it!"
Edyard yelled. He was running now, ignoring the pain in his ankle. Kansine was not far behind, charging like a warhorse, her teeth gritting in determination. Boyd came skidding down the steps from the bakery and took off after them.
"Stop!"
Dinlay proclaimed loudly, holding out a hand as if that alone would bring the whole city to a halt.
"You are under arrest!"
"Oh, crap!" Maxon growled under his breath, and instinctively started to move back toward Dinlay. They came together as the three gang members ran into them. Fists were swung, legs kicked out. Third hand scrabbled and pushed. Maxon went down with one of the gang members sprawling on top of him, his head cracked against the pavement. Dinley was shoved hard against the wall of a hat shop, flailing wildly to regain his balance. Then the gang member on top of Maxon scrabbled to his feet and fled with his companions. Dinley started to chase after them.
"Come back!"
Edyard howled in frustration. He reached Maxon, who was struggling to get upright, hand clamped on the back of his head. A trickle of blood was running down his fingers.
"What do we do?"
Maxon demanded, wincing from the pain. Edyard's farsight could follow Dinley easily enough as he ran toward the northern end of Macoon Street. The three gang members were 10 yards ahead of him.
"Save him,"
he growled, furious with Dinley. He sent a single clear thought to his G-Eagle, who immediately took flight. Kansin was slowing as she approached Edyard and Maxon, her face red. Boyd was charging behind her.
"Come on,"
Edyard said, and took off again. Kansin flashed a look of exasperation and hurried along.
"You okay?"
Boyd shouted as he ran past Maxon.
"Yeah."
Maxon took a breath and started running. The G-Eagle streaked along Macoon Street, swiftly overtaking Edyard and Kansin. It shot forward, rising high above the roofs, looking down to see Dinley racing on, his glasses askew. The three gang members almost had reached the end of the street, which came out just below Birmingham Pool, where a silver-blue bridge connected Jevons with the lower point of Golden Park. As always, Birmingham Pool was thick with gondolas. A half-dozen moorings lined the edge beside the junction with the Outer Circle Canal, all hosting several waiting gondolas. The G-Eagle dipped down to the moorings, as Edyard tried to work out which of the glossy black craft belonged to the gang. If this was a trap, they would have their escape well planned. Just before it happened, the G-Eagle was aware of two other birds, close and closing. It pivoted on a wing, looking up in time to see its attacker plummeting toward it. Another G-Eagle, bigger, with talons clad in sharpened iron spikes. The impact punched it savagely. Gold and emerald feathers burst out of the collision point. Spikes sank into its front shoulder, slicing through skin and muscle, severing veins. Then the bigger G-Eagle twisted to try to snap the central wing bone. Edyard's G-Eagle fought back, writhing to clamp its jaws on its attacker's rear wing. The two of them tumbled, falling fast. Then the second attacker hit, iron blade talons ripping into flesh. Edyard and his G-Eagle screamed as one as its wing broke. Edyard saw talons rake toward his face and ducked. His G-Eagle's mind abruptly vanished from perception. All that was left was a falling mass. The other two G-Eagles hurtled away over Birmingham Pool. Edyard was sure he heard the splash as his bird's body hit the water.
"What happened?"
Kansin cried.
"Dear lady, they are waiting for us."
Edyard pulled his perception down to find Dinley emerging from the end of Macoon Street.
"Stop, Dinley, for the lady's sake, I'm begging you."
He pushed his tired legs harder, sprinting for the end of the street. 30 yards.
"I see them,"
Dinley replied gleefully. He gifted the squad, who saw the three gang members clustered above one of the moorings. They grinned barbarously. For the first time, there was a pulse of uncertainty in Dinley's mind. He slowed to a halt, 10 yards away on the edge of the pool. Still, the gang members did nothing but wait.
"Stay there,"
Dinley told them, taking big gulps of air after his helter-skelter dash, and waving a finger like an ancient schoolmaster dealing with a naughty class. They laughed at him. Edyard burst out of Macoon Street. Directly to his left was the Outer Circle Canal, with the silver-blue bridge ahead, arching over the side of the pool directly into Golden Park. On his right, the buildings ended to provide a curving alameda around the side of Birmingham Pool. Neat stacks of crates were piled above the various moorings, with shopkeepers and G-monkeys sorting out their goods with the gondoliers. Tall, weeping asphalt trees formed a long line between the edge of the pool and the alameda's crescent facade, their blue and yellow tiger-stripe leaves starting to crisp with the end of summer. A lot of pedestrians were strolling around.
"Dinley!"
Edyard shouted as he ran as fast as he could toward his isolated squadmate. Dinley glanced around, a hand adjusting his glasses. Arminel stepped out from behind one of the asphalt trees, 15 yards from Dinley. He had a revolver in his right hand. Edyard watched helplessly as Dinley finally realized the danger and began to run. Arminel brought the pistol up.
No!
Ediard bellowed at his adversary. It's me you want! Dinlay opened his mouth to cry out in horror. Arminel fired. He was smiling as he pulled the trigger. Dinlay's shield was not strong enough to ward off a pistol shot. Arminel's aim was excellent. The bullet struck Dinlay in the hip, just below his dross silk waistcoat. Half the pedestrians around Birmingham Pool yelled at the blast of pain flooding out from Dinlay. Then the vile heat of the bullet's penetration faded rapidly. Dinlay looked down disbelievingly at the blood pumping out of the wound. He collapsed. Ediard was with him in seconds, falling to his knees, skidding into his limp friend. Dinlay's eyes were wide. He was panting in short gulps, one hand clasped over the bullet hole, skin covered in blood.
I'm sorry, he whimpered.
A mass of screaming had broken out along the Alameda. People were racing for cover. Families hugged each other, cowering from the gunmen. Right in the center of all the commotion, Ediard heard the revolver's mechanism snick. He widened his shield to encompass Dinlay. The bullet smacked into his side, shunting them over the rough ground, but the shield held. He snapped his head around to snarl at a disconcerted Arminel. Not so fucking easy, is it? He yelled defiantly. Arminel fired again. Ediard groaned in an effort as the bullet hit his neck. The shield held. Just. Then someone else fired a shot. Bastards. I knew this was an ambush. Amazingly, his shield held. If anything, it was easier to maintain now. His heart was pounding hard. Anger had washed every other sensation away, making it simple to concentrate on the shield, to see his mind's power, to channel it correctly. Two more revolver shots thudded into his shield as he lay there, arms hugging Dinlay protectively. They shunted the pair of them a few inches over the ground, but that was all.
Die, you little shit!
Arminel shouted. Ediard felt the man's third hand shove against him. He was not nearly powerful enough to get through Ediard's shielding. Ediard laughed. Then another third hand was pushing. A third. The three gang members they had chased joined in. Ediard gasped as he and Dinlay started to slither over the ground.
Ediard!
Kansin cried.
Stay back, he commanded.
The gang members gave a final push. Ediard and Dinlay were propelled over the edge of the pool and dropped 3 yards into the water. The impact broke Ediard's grip on Dinlay. He thrashed about just under the surface, trying to catch his friend again. Water occluded his farsight, making it difficult to perceive. He just made out Dinlay's wretched thoughts drifting down below him, close to extinction. His own clothes were saturated, weighing him down. It was relatively easy to swim downward, following Dinlay's slow descent to the bottom of the pool.
Ediard!
Dinlay's thoughts were weakening. It was dark and cold. Ediard could make out a shadowy mass, or maybe he was perceiving it. He pushed himself farther down, kicking with boots as heavy as lead. His lungs were burning, making every stroke painful. He would have called the city to help, but he knew it could do nothing. Water was pushing into his nostrils, scaring him. His hands snagged something. Through the gloom he could see faint dots of light. Dinlay's polished tunic buttons. His fingers groped frantically, and he got a grip on some fabric. Now all I've got to do is get to the surface. When he tilted his head up, he could see the silver mirror surface. It seemed a long way above him. His lungs did not hurt quite so much anymore. His vision was surrounded by red speckling, pulsing in time with his heart. When he kicked his legs, they barely moved. His boots were pulling him down.
Oh, lady, help!
Something knocked into his shoulder. His far sight perceived it as a slim black line.
Ediard!
The combined long talk of Kansin, Maxen, and Boyd shouted at him, Ediard, grab the pole! They were a long way off. The end of the punt thumped into his shoulder again. Ediard seized it. Abruptly, he was moving upward. It was a huge effort not to let go of Dinlay. Then the water was growing brighter. He broke the surface with an almighty gasp of air. Someone jumped in beside him and held on to Dinlay. They were right beside a mooring platform. Hands clutched at his uniform, and he was hauled onto the planks, coughing and sputtering. Kansin's anxious face loomed large over him.
Oh, lady, Edyard, are you okay?
He nodded, which set off another bout of coughing. Hands slapped hard on his back as he rolled over onto his side and vomited up a thin, disgusting liquid. Maxen and a couple of gondoliers were dragging Dinlay onto the platform, blood still pumping out of his hip wound. Boyd was in the water, his face pale.
Dinlay, Edyard called weakly.
We've long shouted for a doctor, Cansine assured him. You just lie back.
Edyard didn't. He watched Maxen start giving Dinlay the kiss of life. This was the third time his life had been struck by the force of anarchy and destruction. First the ambush in the forest on the way back from Witham, then the death of Ashwell, now this. And that was too many.
No,
he spit. Not again. I will not allow this to happen. People cannot live like this.
Edyard, sit back, Cansine ordered sternly.
Where is he? Where's Arminel?
Stop it!
He clambered to his feet, swaying slightly as he looked around, taking deep breaths. The edge of the pool was crowded with people, all looking down at the mooring platform. He turned toward Birmingham Pool. Most of the gondolas had come to a halt as the drama played out. One was moving, fast. Edyard blinked the salty pool water from his eyes, sending his farsight lashing out. Arminel was standing on the gondola's middle bench. He gave Edyard a rueful shrug, his thoughts glowing with cheery regret. It was as if he had lost a football game. Nothing more. Certainly nothing important. They'd play another game one day, and that time the result might be different. Edyard's rage left him, dropping away like the water dripping off his soaking clothes. He felt eerily calm. One of the gondoliers looking over Maxen's shoulder took a frightened step backward.
Edyard?
Cansine said in a subdued voice. He had not known such a thing was possible. He simply did it. There was no choice. As before, Arminel's gondola was moving too quickly. They'd never catch him, never bring him to justice. Edyard's third hand reached out to the water beside the mooring platform and steadied it. I'm finishing this, he declared forcefully, one way or another. Edyard stepped on the patch of water he was controlling. An astonished gasp went up from the spectators around the edge of Birmingham Pool. Edyard grinned viciously and took another step. Another. He moved his third hand's grip smoothly, always keeping the leading edge of the stabilized patch just ahead of himself. Arminel's humor shattered. At the rear of the gondola, the two gondoliers stopped maneuvering their punts and stared fearfully as Edyard walked across the pool toward them. There was absolute silence as he strode purposefully to the craft. Every gondola in Birmingham Pool was stationary. Gondoliers and passengers stared in awe and trepidation as Edyard walked past.
Move!
Arminel yelled furiously at the gondoliers. Get us out of here! They did not respond. The two gang members, sitting on the bench with Arminel, slowly put their hands up and edged away from Arminel. Edyard was 10 yards away when Arminel dropped a hand to his waist, where the revolver was tucked into his belt. He could sense the man's uncertainty, his fright. The animal backed into a corner. Nobody had any choices left now. As he covered the last few yards to the gondola, Edyard opened his mind and long-talked with all his might.
So that everybody knows. So that no judge or lawyer is in any doubt of this day.
And he gifted them with his sight. Macathran, from the mayor in his orchard palace, down to the sailors in the port district, saw a gondola with 4 men cowering, hands clamped over their ears. The 5th man stood straight, loathing on his face as his hand gripped the revolver sticking out of his belt. They felt Edyard's mouth move.
Okay, gang man, your time in this city is over. If you think different, give it your best shot.
Arminel brought the revolver up. Macathran en masse flinched as the muzzle steadied not 2 feet from Edyard's eyes.
Fuck you,
Arminel snarled. He pulled the trigger. The single unified scream that rang out from the city later was said to be heard halfway across the Iguru Plain, when they all gathered their breath and realized they were still alive. They saw the bullet. It floated motionless 6 inches in front of Ediard's face. Ediard's mouth moved again, this time into a thin smile. Arminel's expression was frozen in shock. The last of the gifting allowed Macathran's citizens to experience Ediard, shaping his third hand into a fist. He slammed it forward into Arminel's face. Bone went crunch as the man's nose broke. Blood spurted out. His feet left the bench as he was thrown backward. He landed with a mighty splash in the water, which closed over him. "You're all under arrest," Ediard announced. It was pandemonium on the side of Birmingham Pool as the gondola made its steady way to the mooring platform where Cancine, Boyd, and Maxen waited. On the Jeevan side, they were crammed 15 deep around the edge. Frenzied kids were running over the blue and silver bridge from Golden Park, hanging over the railings, cheering and waving. Over 100 constables stood behind the mooring platform waiting. Half of them were Dinlay's family. People still were pouring out of the surrounding districts into the Alameda to see history as it unfolded. Boulder lads were shinnying to the top of the Hasfold trees to get a better view. Ediard walked slowly behind the gondola, praying to the lady that he wouldn't screw up now, that his telekinetic strength would hold out, and he would not fall ignominiously back into the water. Out there in the crowd surrounding the pool, he saw Cetasis and Kavine standing in front of a big contingent of Silverham Market stallholders, leading the applause. A huge array of well-groomed family girls greeted him with shrill, saucy laughter as they flashed their petticoats and bloomers. Isowicz and his family were there. Evola, Nicolar, and all the girls from the dressmakers were waving frantically and screaming to attract his attention. He even thought he saw Dybal and Biduli laughing excitedly among the crowd, but by then he definitely was feeling tired. The gondola's prow touched the mooring platform. Constables steadied it. Captain Ronark quickly took charge. Che and several of the largest constables from Jeevan Station handcuffed Arminel and his accomplices. A path was cleared across the Alameda, and the prisoners were marched back to the station. Ediard finally stepped up onto the platform. His legs nearly gave out. He was trembling from exertion. Captain Ronark snapped to attention and saluted him. Cancine gave him a huge kiss to the delight of the crowd. "You lady damned idiot," she whispered into his ear. "I'm so proud of you." Maxen pounded his back. Boyd gave him a fierce hug. "Dinlay?" Ediard said. "The doctors have him," Maxen yelled above the thunderous sound of the crowd. "He'll be okay. The bullet didn't hit anything vital. Not that he's got anything vital in that area." "You scared the living crap out of us," Boyd said, wiping the tears from his eyes. "What a stunt, you madman." "Look around you, Ediard," Cancine said. "Make sure you see it all. This will be the day you tell your great great-grandchildren about." "Wave to them, you dick," Maxen ordered. He grabbed Ediard's hand and held it high, waving and shouting wordlessly. The cheer that erupted as Ediard grinned sheepishly up at the worshipful horde was scary in its power. The mental strength of so many people united in veneration was overwhelming, verging on a physical force. His grin broadened as Maxen swung him around so that those on the other side of the Alameda could see him. "If there was an election today, you'd be mayor," Boyd said. "Listen to them," Maxen said. "They love you. They want you. You!" He laughed uproariously. Ediard stared over at the blue and silver bridge, convinced the kids hanging over the railing would fall. They were leaning out so far. They were chanting something. At each call, their fists punched the air in unison. "What's that?" Ediard asked. "What are they saying?" "You," Cancine shouted back. "They're calling for you." Then Ediard heard the cry in full and laughed. "Water! Walker!" the crowd chanted in adoration. "Water! Walker! Water! Walker! Water! Walker!" This concludes The Dreaming Void, Book 1 of the Void Trilogy. The story will continue in Book 2. Please visit our website, www.tabletopnext.com. Tantor.com for more information on our growing library of unabridged audiobooks and to take advantage of special offers. Or call toll-free 877-7-TANTOR to request a catalogue.